school, they started in the first grade. I didn't say to the sister, this kid is super bright. He is super bright. Put him in the fourth grade. No way. He's not ready for the fourth grade. Sure, he's smart. Of course he's bright. He's mine. But he's not ready for the fourth grade. He's ready for the first grade. So put him in the first grade. When ready, he'll go to the fourth grade. Not difficult, eh? Now it says, when ready, we say something like this. If you're not ready, don't say it. Go back somewhere else. Go back to three, usually, and get ready. If you're not ready, you'll know if you're ready. And don't kid yourself. If you're ready, you're ready. Right? It's like a job. If you they make you the boss, you're not ready. You're not going to be the boss very long. Sex, either you're ready or you're not ready. If you're not ready, it's not going to be very much fun. Hey, ooh, you know? What happened to you? I'm not ready. That never happened to me, of course. I have a regular, ongoing sex life. How many times a week is semi-annually? You look like you would know that. A little attempted humor there. I know that, please. Thank you ever so. When ready, now I want you to listen to me, Chris. We're going to do this again together, too. Listen to me. It says, my creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and to my fellows. May I do your will as I leave here, as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. Here is the next line. It's the most important line there is. Now listen to this. You ready? We have then completed step 7. See? Now the step has only 7 words in it. It says, humbly asked him to remove. I've endured, and so have you, a couple of million boring lectures on humility. I don't give a lecture on humility. There are not enough people here. Got to think fast now. You got to go. Besides which, if I could have the step and back me, I would show you. Humbly is an adverb. Is that not true, counselor? Educated person. Humbly is an adverb. And adverbs modify verbs. Is that not true, doctor? That is true. So it says, humbly ask. Humbly is an adverb. It's describing how you're supposed to ask your father for something. You know how to ask your father for something. Please, daddy dear. You don't demand things from your father, do you? It pisses him off. You ain't going to get it. Right? Now listen, they could have written the 7th step another way. They could have said we all became humble. They could have said we all practice humility. They could have said a lot of stuff. They didn't do that because it wasn't true. He was having a conversation with this thing that was on fire. And quite naturally, Moses said to this fire, who are you? And the fire said, I am that I am. And Moses said, thank you for clearing that up. For a moment there, I thought I was talking to a tree that was on fire. That's the way this guy was. What's the power? I said, is it God? He said, if you want it to be. Sure, if you want it to be. Whatever you say. And he says, listen, what are you worrying about? What do you care? Have you not experienced the removal of the desire to drink? I said, yes, I have. He said, what the hell more do you want? for Christ's sake. It's all over for you. If you don't think about drinking, you're never going to drink. Is that a power grain? That's it. You don't have to get all excited about God. Now, later on, sure. There is a power, is there not? A power greater than? Of course there is. Do you feel it in this room now? Huh? It's here. It's the same power that Bill brought to Bob. It's free, it's available, anything you want. It's a power greater than our own. And you come to believe. It wasn't just, you know, fast and it happened. I came to believe this. And then I learned later on what it was. And what it was is nothing less. What it is nothing less than the power of God. That's what it is. Nothing less. And our book tells us that over and over again. And very fortunately for me, our book tells us more than that. It talks of God all the time. And it says this. It says, God does not make hard terms with those who seek him. And this is true. Is this a hard term? Being in this beautiful place? I've experienced this. I've been over in St. Simon and Sea Island and places like that. This is the first time I've ever been on Jekyll, but I know this coast. This is not hard terms. Is this difficult? To be with people you know for a weekend? People who care for you? People for whom you care? These are not hard terms. For me to see Jim and all my old friends here, Steve and Jennifer from North Carolina, not hard terms. These are good terms. Easy stuff. Easy stuff. Eh? Easy. Doesn't require anything. And I came to believe because it happened to me. That's all. I experienced it. And if this is so, why wouldn't I want to stay with it? Of course I want to stay with it. Of course. He said to me, listen, you got to make up your mind what you're going to do. So what are you talking about? He said, make up your mind. You're going to stay here, or you're going to go back where you came from? I said, are you kidding me? I'm going back there where the noseless one lives? The Irish call whiskey the creature. I'm going out there where the creature gets me? Not a chance, brother. He said, good, then you got to do certain things. I said, I'll do, you know, whatever you tell me to do. He said, good, do a fourth step. I said, not now. I'm working. I said, he said, you make up your mind to stay here. He was talking about the third step. I said, how about God? How about my will? How about my life? He says, what would God do with your life? What are you, crazy? God doesn't want your life. He gave it to you. Why would he want it back? Don't be ridiculous. I don't make too many pronouncements. And I'll make here's a pronouncement for you. There is no requirement in this program that you turn anything over to anybody for any purpose ever. Just forget about it. God doesn't want your life. For Christ's sake, he gave it to you. That's your life. It's a personal, individual, unique life, and it's yours. You do with it as you will. Now, for alcoholics, we best find out the truth of the matter. And our book says, here's the truth. A life based on self-will can hardly be termed a success. That was a hard lesson for me to learn, because by all exterior appearances, material appearances, I was a success. Nobody else in my neighborhood became a law professor, for Christ's sake. When the cops, and there's nothing wrong with that, cops, firemen, burglars, some armed robbers, a lot of priests came out of there. And judged by all of that, I was a success. I was so successful that I spent my 35th birthday in a mental institution. And I was only there a matter of minutes when I discovered a very serious architectural deficiency in the building. There was no doorknob on my side of the door. Happy birthday to you. I explained to a man in a white coat who was standing around, I said to him, on this very day, I have attained age 35. Therefore, under the Constitution of the United States of America, I am eligible for the office of president. He urged me not to plan any campaigns. He said there were two other presidents in residence. I think Washington and Jefferson were there. A life based on self-will can hardly be termed a success. See, I deluded myself. I was in some kind of a time warp. I find this with alcoholics. Alcoholics Anonymous is full of used to bees, you know? The youngest sales manager, the youngest vice president, the youngest professor, the youngest colonel, the youngest used to be. And I'd pull that crap and my sponsor would say, listen, hey, you're not a professor anymore. That's a long time ago. Well, I was one. Yeah, he said, but you got fired. Well, you shouldn't have fired me. So why the hell not, you drunken clash? You don't show up. Bastard. God, I would pout, you know. Ooh, I had that resentment for years. Sons of bitches. Now he says, make up your mind. You're going to stay here or are you going back there? Are you kidding me? That's like saying, would you like to go back to Duluth, Minnesota for a weekend? I've been to Duluth, Minnesota. Thank you very much. Once is enough. I saw the bridge. I saw the lake. I froze my ass off. I ain't never going back, ever, no matter what happens. So you know what's going to happen. They'll call me next week to go. I said, I'm in. You know, I'm going to stay. Good, he said. Now, we pray around here, he said. Oh, so I know that. No, I've been around. I know this. And now I'm in like my 6 months. He said, well, that's how we take the third step. We say a prayer. Ah, I said, sir. I know all about that. I went 19 years to the Catholic school system. I do prayers of all types, Latin, French, English, prayers for everything. Intention of our Holy Father, the Pope. Prayers for the crops. I'm in the South Bronx. We used to pray for the crops every fall. The Italians were growing marijuana up there. Otherwise, nothing grew. You know, the Irish were drinking beer. The Italians were up growing marijuana. Yes. So we'd pray for the crops. And I kept pestering him for a job, you know. I needed a job. I mean, a good job. I had 7 children. I had no money. I had more, you know, I had a lot of things to worry about. And he used to go poo-poo, like, you know, like it was nothing. And you know what? It's nothing. He pointed out to me what the book says. He says, you know, there is a law of supply at work here, spiritual supply. I said, I didn't know that. He said, well, look, right before the third step prayer in the book, look what it says. Here's what it says. When we sincerely took such a position, the position of the third step, making a decision to stay here, all kinds of remarkable things happened. We had a new employer. Being all powerful, he provided us with everything we needed, provided that we stayed close to him and did his work well. See? That's the spiritual law of supply. If you stay close to him and do his work well, you will get it. Now, what do they say? You don't get what you want, you get what you need. Is that what they say? That's a lot of bullshit. You get what you get. whether you need it or want it or anything else. And believe me, brothers, if you're going to get it, you're going to get it. Now, the trick is, what do you do with it once you got it? Correct? You're going to get it, and you best learn how to handle it. And the way you handle it is through that. Here's the prayer. I offer myself to thee, to do with me, to build with me, as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do your will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them will give evidence to those I would help of your love, your power, and your way of life. May I do your will always. Now, I'm going to go through that prayer again. And for those of you who want to, you say it right after me. Because the line after that prayer says, many of us found it helpful to take this step with another person. So if you want to take it with each other and with me, here we go. I offer myself to thee, to do with me, to build with me, as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do your will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them will give evidence of your love and your power and your way of life. May I do your will always. I would take a break. Thank you. To that section of the fifth chapter in the book where it says, A, we were alcoholic and could not manage our own life. B, probably no human power could relieve our alcoholism. And see that God could and would if he was sought. Right after that, the next line is being convinced. We were at step three, where you and I just ended. At step three, being convinced, it says, now if you're not convinced that you are alcoholic and cannot manage your own life, if you're not convinced of that, if you're not convinced that no human power is going to relieve your alcoholism, and if you're not convinced that God could and would if he was sought, then you're not at step three. See, this book tells you exactly where you are and exactly what you are to do next. And when you get to the third step, it says some of us, and we said that prayer together because it says that we found it helpful to take this prayer with someone else. Then it says, we then proceeded on a vigorous course of action, we got down to causes and conditions. My sponsor at this point said to me, you got to write an inventory. You got to write an inventory. You got to find out what's the matter with you. I said, yeah, I'm working on that. 75% of Alcoholics Anonymous is working on the fourth step at all times. Everybody's... You know, you go to the kind of meetings I like where you go around the table, you get to the first step, and a lot of these idiots think the first step says, tell me how you drank. So they tell it, who the hell cares? That's what they think it says. And then they say, the second step is the next week, and they think the second step says, tell us how crazy you were. So they tell you a lot of bullshit about how crazy they were, like you could. Nobody cares. On the third step, oh my God. Oh. Are they close to God? Oof. They're so turned over, they don't know whether to wear the blue tie or the red tie till God speaks, you know. Oh. So what are you going to do Thursday? Oh. Day at a time, God's talking to me, you know. They're all fully turned over. They have no life. They have no will. It's wonderful. Then you get to the fourth step. I'm working on that. I pass. I make the first three steps, I make the equivalent of the emergency room in a hospital. And everybody knows that the emergency room in a hospital is always on the ground floor because you gotta get there. It's an emergency. And the function of the emergency room in a hospital is not to, diagnose and cure disease. The purpose of an emergency room in a hospital is to take care of emergencies, to make sure that you have the bodily fluids are right, the vital signs are right, the pressure's right, bind up the wounds, sew up the suture up the stuff, and make sure the guy don't die. That's why you have emergency rooms. And when they get the emergency taken care of, they take him up to the 7th floor and they kill him at leisure up there. Because when they get him up on the 7th floor, they can do search and research and a couple of zillion dollars worth of tests. And then they say, you got a problem with your kidney, Charlie. And they give you a diagnosis that your kidney's not working. Then they give you a prognosis. You give you a protocol, you take this stuff, and in a little while, you'll be all set. And that's what the first three steps are about. That's emergency treatment. You know, that's an emergency. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, in my own mind, anyhow, it was an emergency. God damn it, I was going to die or blow up in 1,000 pieces and never be found again unless somebody would help me. Now, I didn't formulate it that way, but Jesus, it was an emergency. Now, I'm around 7 or 8 months, still going to meetings every day, and I start talking funny. My sponsor starts hearing crap come out of me. I'm saying things like, a lot of smoke in those meetings. You know, people, they smoke cigarettes. You ever notice that? A lot of smoke. Makes my eyes hurt. Now, just 8 months ago, I'm in some saloon. It's 5 o'clock in the morning, and the fucking smoke is so thick, I can't even see the walls. And the guy's trying to close, and I'm begging him to stay open. No, don't close. I like it here. Look how bright my eyes are. No, no, never what smoke. This is wonderful. Nah, it's fine. It's fine. And then you hear crap like, there's no parking. Did you notice that? I mean, they should have parking for us. This prick did not have a car 6 months ago. And then you hear crap that's really pathetic. You know, they say things like, I gotta spend some more time with the family. Isn't that pathetic? The whole family saying, get out of here. Get out of the house. Go to those meetings. Give us some peace, quiet. Daddy's here. Yeah. Then all of the old people have to get their teeth fixed. And all of the young people are gone to the community college. They're all going to be brain surgeons. We had a kid in Miami, he said he wanted to be a doctor. He said he didn't want to become a doctor, he just wanted to be a doctor. Yeah. Drive around in a Mercedes, play golf on Wednesday afternoon. And my sponsor said to me about this, he said, this is the medicine. You understand? The first three steps, that's the emergency. Now, he said, you are at a place where we give you the medicine. This is the medicine for alcoholism, steps 4 through 10. That's the medicine. And that's the way he put it. Let's face it, gang, medicine is not pleasant, you know. Medicine is not a lot of fun. It's not a barrel of monkeys. But we have an attitude about medicine. We're nurtured that way. And if the physician says to us, it gives us a bottle of this brown, noxious crap, and says, take this 4 times a day, we do. It says 1 teaspoon every 4 hours. We take 4 tablespoons every 20 minutes and see if it... 1 is good, 2 is better, we better take 6. This shit may not work. Or the physician says, hey, you see this thing here? Stick it up your ass. And we say, how far? You know, it's going to help? Yeah, well, we'll do it. You know, that's medicine. Around here we say, listen, write down on a piece of paper. I'm working on that. No, my God. Not this minute, you know, I'm getting there. I'm circling around it, you know. It's ridiculous. And, you know, who wants to take the medicine? And listen, if you have the flu and you go to the good doctor and he gives you a bottle of the brown noxious shit and you come back 2 weeks later and you're worse and he says, did you take the medicine? You say, no. Why didn't you take the medicine? I don't like medicine. Well, what the hell did you come here for in the first place? Well, I don't like coughing and all of that stuff. I'm trying to sleep nights. I need. Yeah, well, I gave you the medicine, but you know, it tastes terrible. You'd have to call a psychiatrist, right? Because he's not got the flu. He's nuts. Put him in a loony bin. He's crazy. You give him the medicine, he won't take it. That's us. Here's the medicine. Not a chance. You're a trusted servant. I'm not going to run. Are you crazy? I have a very fine mind, very logical mind. I see, you know, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. What in God's name has that got to do with drinking? What the hell is that? Was it witchcraft? That has nothing to do with drinking. I write some crap on a piece. What the hell? Imagine if you went to a doctor and say, I drink 7 gallons of water a day. Ah, maybe you're a diabetic. Well, if you're a diabetic, tell you what, you go home, write down a list of people you hate, and you'll be all set. I want another opinion. Well, you're ugly. Thank you. Yeah. But that's what we get here. See, nobody wants to take the medicine. Nobody wants to take the medicine. They don't want to take the medicine. And they want to get better, but they don't want to take the medicine. And it's all code, you know. They talk this code, this crap. You know, the rooms are crowded, and unfortunately they go away, and a lot of them don't come back. Some come back, some don't. But you got it. It's like anything else. You got to take the medicine. Now, people come, and they try to run these games by with the force. If they come to me, for instance, because I'm old, and they say to me, beloved guru, and I say, yes, my son. And they say, I'm having a problem with the fourth step. And I say, you are full of shit. Because it's true. They're not having a problem with the fourth step. Here's the problem. The problem is they have never made a decision to turn their will and their lives over to the care of God as they understand it. The reason they have never made a decision to turn their will and their lives over to the care of God as they understand them is that they have never come to believe that there is a power greater than their own which could restore them to sanity. The reason they have not yet come to believe that there is a power greater than their own that could restore them to sanity is that they have never accepted and conceded to their innermost self that they are powerless, that their lives are unmanageable. It is not a fourth step problem. It's a first step problem. You understand? If you admit your own powerlessness and helplessness and uselessness, you will do anything. You will go to any length. And this is not a big deal. This is not a big deal. And don't run those games. They come to me and they say they need help with their fourth step. Are you kidding me? I'm supposed to tell you who you hate? How the hell do I know who you hate? I'm supposed to tell you what you're afraid of? I don't know what you're afraid of. I know what I'm afraid of. And that's all the book tells us to do. The book is very clear on this. They even knew smart guys like me were coming around because they put a diagram in for us. See? You just fill in the blanks. Here it is. It starts off by saying very simply, resentments are the number one offenders. Nobody hates like we hate. And forever. Yeah? Guy told me last night, sitting around here, his 50-year-old son called him up and said he didn't give him a bike one Christmas. What in Christ's name is that? Yeah? The world is full of victims. We're all victims. Everybody's a victim. We didn't do it. No, no. It was done to us. We're all victims. I'm from a dysfunctional family. I'm a victim. I didn't get the right sled at Christmas. My sister Marie was a pain in the ass. Grow up. Remember my friend Pogo? He was sitting on the end of that log one day with his pal, the alligator. And he said to him, "I have found the enemy, and it is us." We did it. I did it. Nobody, I'm not a victim. I tell you, I wouldn't sit still as a victim for 5 seconds. You fool around with me, you'll see what a victim I am. I kill people. That's why I was good at what I did. So it says here, write down the resentments. Look, here it is. And it says, put down the name, Mr. Brown. The cause, his attention to my wife. He told my wife of my mistress. Brown may get my job at the office. Now, by any civilized standard of behavior, by any moral code in force in Western civilization, Mr. Brown is a world-class prick. But if I'm mad at him, there's something the matter with me. What is this? Communism in its worst possible form. I'm not allowed to be mad at him. Why? Because I'm an alcoholic. I will drink at him. See, other people can get mad, and they rant, and they rave, and they act like fools. We do that, too. Plus, we drink. Behind every defect of character, there is a drink. And in every drink, there's a drunk. It's that simple. Write down who you hate. And who knows better than you who you hate? You know who you hate. I can help you out. But you know who you hate. Just take anybody close, you hate them. Hate is resentment. From the Latin, resentio, to feel again. You know how that goes? He did that to me. Ooh, let me think about that. I'll run it around one more time. Ooh, ooh. Let me do it again. Ooh, 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 ooh. It's getting worse. Do it one more time. Trouble with me was, when I went into one of those rages, I was too stewed. I used to sit in this chair we had, and I watched TV with one eye like this. I was watching reruns of the Dick Van Dyke Show about 8 o'clock in the morning, and I had a bottle of vodka. And I used to smoke in those days, and I'd be dropping Pall Malls in the chair, it would begin to flame, but I used to take a leak in the chair all the time, so it never really went on fire. It just sort of smoldered and smelled bad, you know. And I'd sit there in my Brooks Brothers underwear, watching the steam come up, you know. And I would hate people, and I would drink at them. I'd rotten son of a bitch. Fire me, wait, bastard. Give me that. One of these days, boy, I plan my comeback. Yeah. I'm going to get dry clothes. I'm going to get my car back from the repossessed bank. I'm going to... So, you sit there and hate people. Resent. Fire me. Ooh. With tenure. Ooh, ooh. Good teacher. Ooh, 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 ooh. Dirty son of a bitch. If I could only get out of this chair, I'd kill him. That's one of the differences with cocaine. It, boom, they're out of the chair with a machine gun. Alcoholics just sort of sit there, you know. I'm fine. You know. How you doing? Fine. I'm fine. That phone, I can't. This is the medicine. It's the medicine. Write it down. It's the medicine. That's all. Write down what you're afraid of. Ooh. Ooh. Those things that go bump in the night. Fear. It says we wrote down our fears even though no resentment was attached to them. You don't have to hate them. Just be afraid. Fear was the ruling emotion of my life when I drank. Fear. I was in a state of continual... It wasn't fear, it was terror. Absolute terror. My hair would stand up on it. Fear. I knew what I was. I knew I couldn't change it. And I knew I was going to die, and I was going to die that way. And brother, I used to say to him, why do I feel so guilty? He said, because you're guilty. And when you're guilty, it engenders very strong feelings of guilt. Zen. And I was guilty all the time, and the guilt increased the fear, and the fear increased the guilt, and the guilt increased the fear, and the fear increased the guilt. And the booze would put it away for about 20 minutes. Huh? Oh, shit. Now, today is 29 years later, and I'm at a red light, and one of those thoughts, you know, floats through your head, you go, oh, Jesus, did I do that? Then I'm looking around to see if anybody knew. You know, I'm the only one in the car. Did anybody see that? This computer we have up here, things go in there, and it produces this stuff, pops out. Fear, fear, fear. Put them down on a piece of paper. See? Then it says, list your faults. Where were you? Selfish? Selfish, all the time, selfish. Dishonest? Hey, if I was talking to you, I was lying to you. You know, alcohol is such a wonderful chemical. I mean, it does exactly what it's supposed to do. I'd wake up at 7:30 in the morning, terrorized. You know, I'd be in there, terrorized, in a wet bed. And I'd say, this is, to myself, this is it. This is the day they all show up at the one place. She who must be obeyed. He who is my boss. The guy at the bank who I lie to every week. The judge that I lie to every other week. Why I can't be there. They're all going to be down in my living room. Now, nobody's been in my house for about 3 years, but they're all going to be there that morning. And then they would drive up with the white truck and the guy with the net, and they'd take me away. I knew it. Oh, brother. And I go in and I'd have a drink in the kitchen, throw it into the sink. I got all these people hanging around, you know, 7 kids, Mrs. O'Keefe, all the rest of all my cheerleaders. Way to go, Pop. I'm fine. Coming home tonight, who knows? Then I get into that saloon on 40th and Lex with Charlie O'Brien. Charlie never got out of grammar school, but he was a very wise person, and he was the bartender. And he would pour me a triple, and I would drink it. Boom. Then I'd give me another triple, and I would drink it. Boom, boom. And then a great calm would descend on me, and peace would float in. And what was I afraid of? What was I worrying about? What is wrong with me? I must have panicked there for a moment. Give me your phone, Charlie. Is this the bank? Yes. You keep that shit up, and I will never borrow money from you again. Boom. Give me the dean of the law school. I'm not coming in today. There's just so much a human can do. Boom, you know. Restore to health in a matter of... not afraid. Master of the universe. Rides again. And that would last for 40 minutes. And then you get another little fix along the way, you know. Drinking was not the problem. It was those in-between periods where you couldn't drink, and those goddamn do-gooders wouldn't let you drink, and they couldn't mind their own business. How come your suit's on fire? I don't know. Leave me alone. Well, what were your faults? It says, put the drink problem aside. What is your faults? Selfishness, self-centered, all of that. And why is this is the what contributes to alcoholism? Why are you nervous, irritable, and discontent? I'll tell you why. Because you're terrified. Because you're full of hate. And you're a lying, cheating, rotten, dirty son of a bitch who stole from your mother, your fathers, your sisters, your brothers, who screwed every boss you ever had. Anything else? All kind of people. people we know and love and admire. Rotten, dirty, right to the core. Sober's skin deep, but drunk is to the bone, brother. And then it goes on to say, write down your sex problems. Got a little sex manual here. And it says, I read now about sex. It does not say now about a deep, meaningful relationship. Or now about love. Or even now about marriage. If you're interested in those things, this is not for you. This says now about sex. See? And none of it says most of us have problems in this area. We put them down on a piece of paper. And then it goes on to say that there are some people among us who want nothing but pure sex all the time. It says some would have us on a straight pepper diet, and others would allow us no flavor for our fare. This is Bill Wilson, 1939. Some people say if you have sex, you're going to get drunk. The book says, oh, no. Book says, not so. That's not in the black part. That's in the white part. This part about you can't get laid until your 18th birthday or something. It's not in the book. The book says what the book always says. It says in this area, sex is a very important area of our lives. No point pulling punches about it. It says the same thing it says everywhere. It says, be honest. Huh? Is that all right in a sexual relationship, to be honest? It says, be kind. Is that something you would like in a sexual relationship? Kindness? Anything wrong with that? Honesty? Kindness? And trust in God. That's what it says. That's what it says. It goes on to say that God alone can judge our sex situation. God alone. That relieves me from a terrible burden. I don't have to judge your sex situation, whatever it may be. You may be making love to alligators for all I know. What do I care? What has it got to do with me? As long as you're honest, caring, that's all it says. And it just repeats what it says all over the book. Where have we been selfish, dishonored, or inconsiderate? Who do we hurt? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We put it all down on paper and look at it. That's all. You look at it. I learned a lot from my fourth step. The man on my fourth step, the person on my fourth step, was not the guy I thought I was. I was operating under a delusion. That's the point of the fourth step, so we know who we are. I was operating under a delusion. I thought, as I said before, I was stuck in a time warp someplace. I was back in, 1959 or 60 instead of 65, 66 now. You might have liked to have known me in 1960. I was smart. I was bright. I was funny. I was a great barroom companion. Great guy to hang around with. Enormous fun to bullshit. And I was just a good guy to be with in 1960 because I wasn't falling down drunk all the time. I was drunk, but not falling down drunk all the time. But, you know, things changed. Mrs. O'Keefe, she who must be obeyed, would say to me when we socialized, she would say, my beloved, which is how she addressed me most times. When we go out this evening, she would say, please do two things for me. And I'd say, tell me what you wish, my treasure, and it shall be yours. And she would say, first, do not get falling down drunk. And secondly, she would say, somewhere in the course of the evening, say, I don't know. I couldn't do it. I couldn't do either one. Nuclear physics, I'm in, you know. Here's what I think. And then when I look at this, I think, here I am, an absolute genius. Great to be with, real pal, friend to all, successful. Then I look at this piece of paper. That's not what I see. What's on there is a terrorized, defective, arrogant human being. So defective, if I were an automobile, it would have recalled me. You know, just get him back. This guy's defective. And I was defective. And I had this fourth step, and I was very anxious to give it to him because he would give me such a pain in the ass about it. So I showed up with my little, I had about three pieces of, you know, yellow stuff the lawyer shoes. And I tried to give it to him, and he wouldn't, he just get, you know, he had this terrible look about him. That sponsor look, you know, they get that someplace. Eh? And he said to me, did you admit this to God? I said, I don't know what you're talking about. He says, look at this step. The step says, admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. He said, did you admit this to God? I said, no. He said, well, admit it to God. I said, well, how do you do that? He says, you admit it to God. And he went away. And I'm sitting here like a dummy with this piece of paper. And I don't know what the hell to do next. I really, you know. Jesus Christ, I did it. Why don't I read it, prick? And he came back a little while. Now, you know, whenever I do the fifth step, whenever I get to this portion of it, I tell a story because I like the story. It's my favorite biblical story. I like the story, and I like the way I told it. And it has to do with the fifth step. It really does. And you all know this story. And the story is about this man who had the two sons. And the younger one came to the father one day, and he said, I want my inheritance. And the father didn't want to do it, and the kid insisted, and much against the father's judgment, he gave him his inheritance, and the Bible tells us the son went afar off and into a strange land, and he engaged, the Bible says, in riotous living, and he experienced wine and women and song. But a great plague came. You know, the Bible, there are always a plagues that come in, or frogs or something. He says, a great plague came to this place. And the boy woke up and all his money was gone. So it's a given that if the money was gone, the women were gone. And when the women went, there wasn't much to sing about. So he was left with the wine, and he lived with a pig farmer. And he slept with the pigs, and he ate the same food that the pigs eat. And that's no place for a boy from a nice Jewish home. And so he said to himself, I will go back to my father. Even the servants in my father's house have it better than I have. Even the servants in my father's house eat better than I do and live better than I do. And I'll never be his son because I walked away from him. But maybe he'll give me a job working for him. And I'll be a worker. And so he started back to his father. And the Bible says the father had been sitting by a window looking all his time. His father had been sitting by this window looking out to see if the son would come back. And the servants came to the father, and they said, he's coming. And the Bible says the father went more than halfway to meet him and welcomed him and hugged him and kissed him and said, you are my son. You have been lost, and now you are found. You have been dead, and now you live. And the father said to the servants, prepare a party for my son. Bring out the food for my son. Bring out the good clothing and the perfume and anoint him and dress him so that we can welcome him back. And the other boy came back from the fields and he saw all this going on. He was annoyed and he wouldn't come. And the father sent the servants over and the servants said, your father says, come over to the party. And the other son said, I'm not going. He said, I've been here all these years working for him. Never once did he throw a party like this for me. Never once did he let me wear that kind of clothes. And I've been doing his work all the time. And the father said to this son, listen, he said, everything I have is yours. I already gave him his. So you're the only one left. When I go, everything around here is yours. But this is your brother who was dead and now he's alive. You come to the party. And so he did. So he did. And I think that's very much the way it was with me and perhaps with you. I had been away for a long time from my father. A long time. And I guess when I sat there, I guess, I don't know, I just, it's too long ago and I'm too fanciful. I guess I said, I'm back. It's me, I'm back. But I know this, he started a party. It's been going on for a long time. It's a hell of a party. Have a good time. Have a good time. And then I had to admit it to myself. And of course, I'm such a bullshitter, I'm capable of bullshitting myself at a moment's notice, you know. I had to really be sure that what I saw there was me. Was me. I was afraid. I was frightened. Then he came back. I said, I did all that stuff. And he said, good, let me see this thing. And he read it over and he said to me, you know, you're pretty average alcoholic. I said, this is pretty routine, garden variety alcoholic behavior. I didn't want him to tell me that. I wanted to be, you know, sort of a roué or something, you know, a real dangerous alcoholic. What the hell, I went in 5,000 bars and I got laid 3 times. That ought to be worth something, you know. Counts as a rake, man of the world, something like that. He's here, ordinary, garden variety. I don't like being average. And he said that this was the beginning. And the book says, you know, there, this book has promises all over it. We know the ones on 82 and 83. Everybody knows those. But in the group I am a member of, we have a big book meeting every Monday, and we read 15 minutes of this book, and then we go around the room. That's why I know the book so well. I've been doing it for all these years. There are promises in every reading every week that we have. Every single reading. The first great promise in the book is there is a solution. There is, whole chapter, there is a solution. There is. I didn't think there was. There is a solution. Now, in the fifth step, it says this. We pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every dark cranny of the past. I don't know why I do this, I cry. Once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. Promise number one. We can look the world in the eye. Promise number two. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Can you imagine an active alcoholic being alone at perfect peace and ease? No possible way, Charlie. Our fears fall from us. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. You see the difference? What you believe, you know, you can believe the world is flat for all I know. But experience is something else. If you go fall off the edge, you can go back and say, hey, it's really flat. Experience is the key to our recovery here. That's what counts, experience. Listen to this. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. The feeling that the drink problem has been solved will often come strongly. And I can report that to you. I got some hope. I got some hope at the second step. When I didn't want to drink anymore, I thought, boy, I don't want to drink anymore. If I don't want to drink, then I'm not going to drink. But if I wanted to drink, I would drink. And if I didn't want to drink, nobody could make me drink except me. That's hope. Hope is the younger sister to faith. Faith is believing something even though your mind and your experience tells you otherwise. Yeah? To be a Christian requires faith, to believe the things that Christians believe requires faith. It all happened thousands of years ago, and a lot of it is highly improbable. You know, Easter is very improbable. Christmas is just as impossible. But zillions of people in the world believe it, and they have faith, and they're happy with it, and God bless them. And now, at the fifth step, I begin to get faith. I'm going to get sober. I'm going to make it. Not like last time. Good stuff. Good stuff. And the book goes and tells me that this source that I'm talking about is no less a source than God. And it says that as I draw near to him, he will reveal himself to me. And I found that to be true in the fifth step and the sixth step. And isn't it true in our own dealings, our so-called relationships, one with the other? You don't tell somebody all about you the first time you see them, right? You want to know about me? Good, come on down where I live and join my AA group. Go to a meeting every night, come by the house, get in the car, let's go. You draw near to me, you'll find out about me. You won't find out that much about me when I do things like this, because you know. But if you really want to know about me, come on down and see how I operate. I go to a meeting every night, come with me. As you draw near to me, I will disclose myself to you. And it is no different. It is no different. With God our Father, no different. As you draw near to him, he will reveal himself to you. And we have a tradition that he reveals himself as a loving God, our ultimate authority. It's the God of our traditions. It is that power that came to you, came to me. It's the power that went from Bill to Bob, from Bob to Bill to here we are on Jekyll Island. Long, long way from Akron, Ohio. And I'm not talking about geography. Here we are, you and I. And what happened to us? We wrote something on a piece of paper, and we brought it, and we admitted it to God and to someone else. And like the prodigal, we came home for the first time in a long time. First time in a long time. And it takes a little while to get used to your father's house again when you've been away. And we're not even halfway there. But that's what the fifth step is all about. You might think it's, you know, to relieve you of guilt and this and that. It's not. It is not. The idea of the fifth step is to once again bring you closer to God. And as you draw near to Him, He will reveal Himself to you. And the book goes on to tell us that the best source of emotional sobriety, which is what we all look for, do we not? Physical sobriety is an easy thing to have. The best source of emotional sobriety, the book says, is God Himself. And why should that not be? He has the same concern for you as a father might. I have experience with that. I know about that. I have children. I know what it is to be a father. I never had a father. I had to learn. I know I'm not the best father. I'm not the worst father. I'm a father. And you go to school on the first one and learn a little more on the second one. By the seventh one, poor little Bess is eating off the floor, you know. And the first kid is highly antiseptic. Seventh kid, throw him a piece of toast to see if he likes it. Because you find out they're very hardy and there's very little you can do to hurt them. Same way here. It's the same way here. You know, I bet you in my course of fatherhood, and all of us who have that experience, probably said no more than we said yes, right? No, no, God damn it. No, no motorcycles. Jesus, no. What the hell are you talking about? Europe, get out of here. When I was your age. Yeah. It's no different here. It's no different. And, you know, I have seven kids. No, none of them are perfect. My kids are all very, very successful, as you would expect. They really are. They really are. And some of you know me, know some of my kids. You can see me. I have one kid on network television every Wednesday night if you want to see it. But I know that this kid may be a little loose with the truth. The other kid is a little bad with money. You know, they all have a little quirk, and I know that. I understand that. And our father, your father or mine, does not expect us to be perfect. Not at all. We're not saints. The point is, you know what the point of all of this is? What's the point? The point is we try to grow along spiritual lines. That's the point. That's what it says. That's the point of this. Not that we stop drinking, not that we get rich and famous, not that we have kids on network TV. The point is we grow along spiritual lines, because it was along spiritual lines that I failed. That's where I failed. I was spiritless, without spirit. It had been extinguished, and I knew it. And there wasn't a goddamn thing I could do about it. I was in there, and I was stuck. And then one day I walk into a room full of eight guys and a woman sitting around drinking coffee. Somebody said, sit down and have some coffee. And I haven't had a drink since. Now, what do you call that? What is that? What in God's name is that? What is it? It's the power of God is what it is. No less. No less. And I'm sure no saint. And if I can do it, anybody can do it. And I know that. And we come now to that sixth step, which some people call the sixth and seventh step the old-timer steps. Maybe that's true, and I guess I'm an old-timer. I'll tell you this, it means a lot more to me now than it did originally. It's taken on a different meaning than first it had. It says that we were entirely ready to have God remove all our defects of character. The Oxford group had the four absolutes, purity, unselfishness, something in love. And the group conscience in 1938-39, when they wrote the book, decided that alcoholics like us could not be absolute anything except dry. We could be absolutely dry. That's about it. We could not be absolutely unselfish or absolutely pure or absolutely loving. That's for saints, and we are not saints. But the closest we come to it is this. We are entirely willing. Now, when I finished my fifth step with him, he said to me, "You're entirely willing to have God remove all your defects of character." I said, "I am." He said, "Yes." I said, "How did that happen?" He said, "You did the first five steps. That's how it happened." Now, you see what it says here? It says they were entirely ready. It doesn't say they wanted to be. They became. They like it. They used to. They made a decision. They were. Bing. Like that. It's a bonus. You do 1 through 5 to the very best of your ability. You get 6. You were entirely ready. Just like they were. Oh, I hear people say that. It's stupid. You know, they just don't think. Say, "I'm working on my character defects." "Oh, yeah, sure, yeah. I'm working on lust this week." "Oh, I know it. I know you are." "Yeah. You know, one of you is so nervous, you horny little rascal." What in the world are you working on your character defects with? What if you're as powerless, I'm as powerless over my defects of character as I ever was over alcohol. I have no way to make myself honest. How am I going to do that? I have no way to make myself pure. That'll never happen. I can act honestly. You know, since I stopped stealing, nobody's caught me stealing. I can act honestly. I can act lovingly. I can act purely. I may not want to, but I could do it. And it says God will do this. So we're back to him again. You notice in the fifth step, they call God by his maiden name. This is not a power greater than our own. This is not God as we understand him. This is God, G-O-D, God. Huh? You know, we sort of bring people along. They show up. And "I don't want to, don't worry about it, Charlie. Nothing about, it's not a religion. Nothing about God here. Don't worry about that. It's perfectly all right." "So, yeah, no, they're praying." "No, no. I tell them they're not praying. You think they're praying?" "No, no. You misunderstand. This is the way we open meetings." "Oh, that's serenity business." "Oh, no, no, no. That's the way we open a meeting." "Ah." Then he said, "Well, at the end of the meeting, the guy grabbed my hand. We said the Lord's Prayer. They're praying. God must be around there. So they're praying." I say, "Please, Charlie, don't be a fool. We're not praying. We are closing the meeting." A lot of people don't have the benefit of a legal education, so they don't see things as clearly as most of us. And you see what happens is the power starts to work on them. Reluctant. Well, half of us never wanted to, all of us never wanted to be here. Who the hell wanted to come here? Reluctant, fighting it every step of the way, and the power starts working on him. Pretty soon he's eating and he's sleeping. Things are happening. His boss is quieting down. She is sullen, but not mutinous. No open rebellion there. And now he gets around to the fifth step. And he says, "God." We say it was God all the time, asshole. Now we're going to tell you who it is. And by this time, he's so full of the power, and he's got these benefits, he says, "I don't care what it is. I'm in. I'm never going back." That's what he says. And he's full of that enthusiasm that makes it so great. And we're ready. That's all. Now, ready is different. A lot of people say they're willing. Willing is one thing. Readying is something else. Lawyers make a big thing out of willing, ready, and able. And most mornings I'm willing to go to work. I'm just not ready. I got to get ready. The work I do, I got to get ready to do it. I can't go over there. I got to shower up, shave, and all the rest of it. And that's what it is readiness. Ready. Entirely ready. For what? To have your defects of character, that's a good thing to do. I have a story I tell all the time with the sixth step that I think is best, is a good explanation of the sixth step. And this story is about one of my hobby. For somebody from where I'm from, I have a very strange hobby. I am a gardener, and I maintain a garden, and I learned about gardening by doing it when I lived in New York, and this one house I lived in, I inherited a garden, and I added to it. And I had a flower garden, I had a vegetable garden, and I had a rose garden. And the way it works up there in the Northeast is around the end of March, beginning of April, things get warmer. You go out, and the winter has killed a lot of the stuff, especially the roses. So you cut back where you can see the winter kill. You can see the color. And you cut that back, and then the substructure there is all stone and rock, and the ground heaves in the cold, and it throws rocks up. It's an inexhaustible supply. So you take all the rocks out of the bed where the vegetables are or the roses or whatever, and you clean it up. You get out the rocks. And then you do a very familiar thing. You turn the soil over. You turn it over so to expose it to the warmth of the sun. And pretty soon, around the middle of April, you can actually reach down and feel the warmth in the ground. So it's time, and I used to grow some stuff from seed and buy seeds and bring it all out and put it in. And then you just watch it. And during the summer months, all you have to do is walk around and get the weeds out. Keep the weeds out of the garden. You walk around with a hoe, and you see something you don't like, you kill it. You want to whack, kill that son of a bitch. That's not my ground. And then especially in the vegetable department, I used to have a salad. You know, I have lettuce and cucumbers. And I had become sort of a hotshot in my AA group. And at fall, at harvest time, I got a brown paper bag, and I go out there, and I grew these big boy tomatoes. They're like softballs. And I get a bag full of those tomatoes. I take them up to my group, and if I liked you, I gave you a tomato. And I say, he gave me a tomato. And I would have a little ceremony. I'd say, this is my tomato. I grew my tomato in my garden. I'm giving you my tomato, which I grew in my garden. See, that's all crap. I didn't grow anything. I didn't grow a thing. God grew the tomato. He sends the water. He sends the sunlight. All I did was keep the soil ready to receive the plant and keep the weeds out, maintain the garden. And boom, you got a big boy tomato, and I take credit for it. It's an easy way to do it. Huh? But there's the truth. God will do this. And over and over and over and over again in our book, it says God will do for us all of the things we can't do for ourselves. True? True. And it starts with removing the desire to drink. And it never ends. It just never ends. It goes on and on and on. And whether you deserve it or don't deserve it, whether you're a good boy or a bad boy, it makes no difference whatever. You're going to get what you get. And most of it's wonderful. My experience is most of it is just wonderful. So if you're ready, why not get on with it? If you want something from your father when you were a child, if you wanted something from your father, you asked him for it, correct? Of course you did. What do you think, he's a mind reader? You ask your father, how about a bike? Huh? Please. No different here. If you're ready, here's what the book says. After this fifth step, here's what the book says. Returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour. See? No, don't take a lifetime, this shit. 1 hour. Getting tired of these pious people. Pain in my ass. Carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book, down from the shelf, that assumes two things. You got this book, and you got a shelf. We turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. See how definite this is? Look. This page here. 59. Carefully reading the first five proposals, first five steps, that's what it says, we ask if we have omitted anything. We are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. Then it makes some kind of a reference to construction that I don't understand. I'm an attorney. If we can answer to our satisfaction, we then look at step six. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can He now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us. Difficult? Is this difficult? 1 hour. That's all. Boom. Then it goes on to say this. When ready. Now, if you're not ready, don't do it. And isn't this true of life? If you're not ready, don't do it. I have, well, I tell you, all these nice, smart children take after their mother. And they all went to school. When they